You're listening to the Autism Weekly Podcast. Each week, we share community voices and bring light to stories that increase awareness, acceptance, equity, access, and inclusion. If you haven't already, subscribe to join the Autism Weekly family. I'm your host, Jeff Skibitsky. This week, we're joined by Dr. Naima Bana Lopez, an assistant professor of special education and a BCBAD at Niagara University in New York. Dr. Lopez specializes in enhancing social communication opportunities for children with developmental disabilities. Her work also explores diversity and equity in special education, empowering natural communication partners to improve outcomes for diverse students and families. With expertise in ABA therapy and special education, Dr. Lopez will be discussing the intersection of these fields with diversity. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Naima Bana Lopez.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, I appreciate you coming on. One of the things I really like to be able to do for our audience is give a picture of, you know, what brought somebody's passion into the field. And maybe you can give us a little bit of insight of, you know, what sparked your interest, both in the field of autism, but also with cultural awareness or kind of the equity component of being able to make sure that we're providing the same service across, naturalizing the service to what people need based off their culture.
Yeah, so autism is a big one. So my first, you know, experience with autism was a movie. I remember watching Zac Efron movie. It's like one of the first movies he made back in the day. I think it was called The Miracle Run. And I watched it with my mom and I was just so intrigued. I was so interested, you know, in autism. And I was a teenager at the time. I remember going online and searching and learning everything about it. But that was it at that point. And then actually, one of my cousin's son got eventually diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorder, what we called it at that time. And we went on a family vacation together to the mountains. I'm originally from Panama, so we went to the mountains of Panama, which it has better climate and all of this. So we were all together. It was this, I remember exactly, it was raining. And I was home with my cousin's son. And we started playing together and I started reading books to him and just having him, you know, read with me. He has complex communication challenges. So I started trying to get him to say some words and his mom approached me and she said, you know, you're really good at that. Have you considered studying something like that? And at that time I think I was a freshman or sophomore in college and I was thinking about doing something related to working with kids. I was thinking maybe psychology, but kids psychology, and I wasn't sure. So I was like, oh, I don't know, this sounds interesting. So I then decided to volunteer at a nonprofit for young adults with autism. They invited me to be, they have art therapy classes on the weekend. So they invited me to support them at that time. So I did that. And I remember after the first time I went, I told my mom, oh, I really want to do this, right? So I changed my major, I moved to the US. To finish my degree because I couldn't finish it back home. And then I'm here. I went all the way. I decided to become a teacher. And then I got my PhD. And to answer the second part of your question, when I was getting my PhD, I did a lot of work with some of my advisors. And an area that I knew kept popping up is how little we knew about working with culturally and linguistically diverse children, especially children on the autism spectrum or children with disabilities in general that have communication challenges. And I thought that because of my own background, the fact that I'm bilingual, the fact that I'm Latina and Indian, you know, I have this very unique perspective that can really, you know, shed light on some of the needs, and I'm able to connect with families a little bit better and do some work, bilingual work and cross-cultural work that maybe some other people don't have as much personal experience with. So that's what got me into it, and that's why I'm here.
Well, I mean, the whole concept of language and communication and being able to understand the effects that has on one's life, it's not just autism specific. It's not disability specific. Is that, like you said, is that being able to understand how to be able to communicate, whether that's across cultures, whether that's across languages, it's empowering. So where is that cross section of you know, somebody who maybe moved from a different country and is coming into a place where nobody's speaking their language versus somebody who might identify autistic, be nonverbal, and is still trying to figure out how to communicate in their life. Is there a very strong commonality between some of that?
I think there is. I just think we still, I and this is something I tell my students, our field is so young, right? Like even 50 years ago, we still didn't know so much about people with disabilities. IDEA was passed, you know, within our lifetimes. The education and the research of trying to figure all of this out is still so young, so new in the big scheme of things that there's still so much we don't know. But I think there is, right? Communication and the cultural, whatever you identify as culture, and the cultural variations of language and communication are so specific that, yes, there are commonalities, but we're still trying to figure them out and see, you know, how we can better support everybody based on their unique needs. Something I'm coming back to in my research is like eventually we're probably going to have to do this, come almost like a UDL approach to diversity, equity, and inclusion, because we may all have different unique circumstances. So what is best practices for someone that may be Latino, if we use those same approaches to work with someone that may be autistic or, you know, someone that's from a low socioeconomic background, we can all benefit somehow, right? So good teaching or good approaches, good instruction, maybe good for everybody. But it's an idea that I'm playing with. I still haven't really formed it.
Well, definitely keep playing with it, because these are conversations that I think that we need to be having more and more frequently, especially in the field of ABA. It's oftentimes we get stuck where we're telling somebody, this is how you have to communicate. This is what you're supposed to look like while communicating to me. This is the language that I'm going to be teaching you in. But when you think about like the, and you mentioned DEIB, but it's that concept of how do I take an ABA program where I'm trying to be able to enhance somebody's communication, enhance their belonging in the world that they would like to be able to access and empower them. How do I take some of these kind of, I guess, concepts and kind of immerse them so that you have the right communication for the right person at the right time?
I think it all boils down to, for me, social validity, right? Like going back to the dimensions of ABA, like, is it effective? Is it generalizable? Thinking about that. And, you know, a lot of times we think of social validity as something that we do at the end. But social validity needs to really be, especially from the research perspective, and then when working with families also, working with clients in general, social validity needs to be embedded throughout. Asking people before, how can this apply in your life? Is this something that you're going to be able to maintain? It doesn't really matter if we give teachers or parents an intervention that we can implement really well, right, when we're in the clinic, but then they're not going to be able to do it at home because they don't have the resources because it's just too hard. So trying to find that so that the tools that we give people and the tools that we give, especially like my work is mostly with parents and teachers, but the tools that we give them are appropriate and effective.
So what would that look like? I mean, can you paint a picture for me? Say we have a student who, and we'll stick with maybe the student who identifies autistic, is that they're nonverbal. They're in a kindergarten classroom, and I'm just kind of creating this picture. And we immediately historically have said, this is how you're going to communicate. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to do vocal programs with you all day long. And that's how I'm going to tell you that you need to communicate. Or I'm going to only teach you sign because I've decided that that's how you're going to communicate. How do you really enhance the quality of that person's life and bring in other people that are involved in their treatment to come to a decision on what's appropriate for this individual versus what feels better for me?
I think you mentioned it, right? Bringing other people that are also involved in the schools. We have the IEP team. We are, you know, by law, we have to all come together. We have to involve the families, thinking about what is going to be effective for them. Like you said, a lot of times in ABA, we focus on things like sign language. We don't really, a lot of behavior therapists might be a little against or have biases against augmented or alternative communication, AAC. So collaborating with an SLP, even if that's not our background, saying, okay, what can we do for that student? Knowing that, you know, there's other things out there, but then bringing the family, we know, for example, a lot of my work also is with AAC. Some families may have some preconceived notions about AAC. They might think that AAC, for example, in this example that we're talking about, may stop their child from speaking. But we know that from research that that's not true. Actually, repeated, you know, the repeated use of an AAC, a lot of the modeling, a lot of behavior, you know, strategies that we use to teach students to use AAC actually can foster verbal language. So using that information, collaborating, working together to first identify what the family thinks is important in terms of communication, what the teacher, maybe the other therapist think the child needs to work on. Maybe they think, okay, the child needs to work on their wants and needs first, right? Or maybe they need to be able to say no. Like, we want them to learn to say no so that they can advocate for themselves. How can we do that? And then work on the other things that we also think are important. And what are some of the ways that we can do that? Can we combine vocal language approximations with AAC, with visual supports, with some sign language, multimodal communication? We use it every day ourselves. So how can we give those same tools to our students and not just limit them to say, okay, no, you have to say it, or you have to, you know, use the sign. We text, we talk on the phone, we point to things. We do that. Why can't they?
No, and I think that I mean, just reading through some of the work that you've done is that the idea of creating this, natural communication partner, that probably is embedded in the thought process of how am I going to teach communication so that it's fluent, it has a value outside of the teaching environment, and that it's practical for how that person's going to now navigate their social and their community environments. But when you're doing that, what effective strategies have you found in kind of trying to train for that natural communication partner and build a community around the individual?
Yeah, like you said, a lot of it is working with the natural communication partners, be it the parents, the teachers, the paraprofessionals, the therapists, to teach them strategies they can use. Because from the research, we know that sometimes we are the ones that, because of our own behaviors, we limit the communication or the opportunities we provide kids with disabilities or students with, mostly students with autism or complex communication needs. So some of the strategies that I teach parents are, I start with things like using visual supports. And some of my work, I've started using things like family photographs because it's very accessible. Families have them on their phones now all the time, right? So sometimes we know that sometimes access or creating communication boards, things like that can be a barrier. So trying to maybe eliminate some of those barriers and say, you can use a family photograph you have in your phone to help your child communicate. You can show it to them, or you can take pictures as you're doing things at home, and then, you know, arrange them in their iPad or arrange them in your phone and have them be able to look at them and point things to you, right? So that's one, but still using some more, traditional visual supports like communication boards, pictures, so on. Another one that I find that we as communication partners often struggle with is that time delay or wait time. Just giving them the time. In my trainings with parents, I actually stop I have a stopwatch for 5 seconds so that we really see, you know, measure how much is 5 seconds. And what I tell teachers and parents is, like, for us, it's a lot easier sometimes to process things and then give an answer. But for our students, for our children, often they need more time to process what we said, analyze what we said, and then come up with a verbal or a nonverbal answer. So wait time is another one that's a big one. And it's the one that parents and teachers tell me usually is the hardest one, even though sometimes it seems like the most simple one, but just waiting for us. Someone told me one time, waiting is a luxury, right? In our society, waiting is a luxury. And that really stuck with me. Like, yeah, in our society where time is money, right? Waiting can be a luxury, but we do that for our students and our kids. So visual supports, increased wait time, a lot of modeling, natural modeling in the environment. modeling when we're using AEC boards or our language or just doing a lot of self-talk. I tell parents, even when you're at the grocery store, start pointing things, tell your children what they are, expose them to that vocabulary. Don't assume that they're not understanding what you're saying or they're not gonna, they're absorbing everything. And then besides modeling, then expanding on what they said. So if they give you a one word answer, like, oh, what is that? Car. Yes, that's the red car. It has four wheels. Just adding something to what they said to, again, do that expand, that modeling of more vocabulary, more language to try to give them a little bit more every time.
I mean, those steps, I mean, they sound very, very logical, but it takes training. It takes the coaching of parents, of teachers to be able to take the time and have the patience to do them. When I think of a child's life, and I mean, say it's a 4 or 5 year old, is that the biggest part of their life, I would imagine, would be trying to be able to increase a peer set, trying to be able to grow that community of those that maybe we want them to engage with and would probably enrich their lives almost more than some of the adults at times. How do we make sure that we're creating that peer opportunity and helping peers to be able to enhance that communication? Or is that second tier? I would imagine that can be concurrently, but
I found that many times that happens very naturally for children, especially at that age level, because they're all learning, they're all absorbing. I think the main thing with that age group is teaching them to be okay with kids that may communicate differently. There's a lot of books now out there that talk about in age-appropriate terms and age-appropriate ways to teach children about disability, teach children about what it's like to have a classmate that is a little bit different than them. And I think that's the main step. And after that, from my experience, kids tend to, you know, be for the most part very, very welcoming to other kids. They try. But there has been some work done in just, you know, teaching young kiddos or even like older than, not only here we're talking about younger, but then when we move on to middle school, high school, then teaching those peers as well, how they can communicate with someone that may have complex communication needs, because that can be one of the barriers. They want to, but they don't know how to. So how is it's okay if you use their device to talk to them as well. It's okay if you want to watch something together, you know, maybe eliminating some of those barriers because we know they want to, but they don't know how to. So it's more of a, in that sense, it's not so much teaching them strategies, but teaching them, it's okay to do it. This is how you do it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's more natural. Yeah. So it doesn't feel so like, because sometimes with peers, it can be kind of like peer tutoring, or it can be like, oh, they take the role of the teacher. And we don't want that. It needs to be natural. It needs to be peer to peer.
And there's so much value in it. But oftentimes I think that we get caught up into that child adult directed communication, and we forget about the how to generalize, how to make it more natural amongst their own peer sets. They got a world to be able to engage in. There are two components that I'd love to explore with you a little bit more. One of them is bilingualism, because we weren't very good at even identifying people of different cultures with the diagnosis of autism historically, is that all of our tests have been kind of biased towards a specific culture, a Caucasian culture. I mean, so that's been in place for a while, which means that our treatment has probably been off. But it also means that as far as communication and bilingualism, we haven't put a lot of effort into truly understanding how to do that and how to do it well. How does that multimodal teaching approach and bilingualism, how does that come into effect? I mean, do they help each other?
Yeah, of course. I think I was thinking about this earlier today, actually, because I was trying to brainstorm something that I want to do related to bilingualism. And I think having that multimodal allows us to code switch, right? When I'm talking to my husband, I'm not only speaking in English or Spanish. He's also bilingual. He's also Spanish is first language. So sometimes I say a sentence in Spanish, but then if I'm talking about work, I may go back to English, right? So when we do multimodal, that's multimodal communication, not multimodal, but bilingual communication, code switching. But then also, like you said, going back to multimodal, having different ways to communicate may give students more of that flexibility to maybe communicate in both languages. And I think something that's really important with bilingualism for students with disabilities is, you know, knowing that they can be bilingual, knowing that they can have, you know, keep their heritage language, because often we've taken that away for a long time, a lot, and still a lot of professionals say, oh, you should only speak to your child in English, right? But what we end up doing by doing that is we take away part of, you know, the child's heritage and then the opportunity to communicate and socialize with family members. I had a student that we gave her an AAC in she was a kindergarten student, and I was able to program some words in Spanish because her grandparents spoke Spanish. And her mom came back and told me, like, oh, that got so much buy-in with the grandparents because they were able to say, oh, look, you're speaking Spanish as well. You have some words in Spanish. And it just built a lot of, not, I don't want to say community, but it helped build that relationship between the child and the grandparents that they would have missed out on if they didn't have that part of their heritage language and their communication. So I think it's really important to take that into account. And especially when working with culturally linguistically diverse families, knowing that extended family members are going to be really involved, usually in the child's lives, grandparents, aunts, uncles. So even if mom and dad speak English fluently, who else is involved in the child's life? And how can we get that child to also be able to interact with them? Because if not, their siblings that don't have a disability are going to be able to, but then this child is going to be in the corner playing by themselves, which can exacerbate the impact of the disability and, you know, limit the opportunities they have to communicate with their family. Yeah,
absolutely. And it breaks my heart at times watching, even within a nuclear family, where it's, you got one parent who maybe has a little bit more proficiency in English, and you got a provider who's only teaching the child in English. The other parent has no way to engage, to communicate, to be a part of their child's life other than through the nonverbal components. And it's almost like, you know, why would we be missing that? Why wouldn't we be seeing those factors? And I guess that kind of teases us back to, you know, that culturally responsive practice. And how do we as clinicians make sure from day one that we are culturally responsive, especially as it deals with communication? Like, so when you enter into that relationship where you're helping to be a part of that family's treatment journey, how do you make sure you're doing it correctly for that family?
That goes back to that social validity, right? Before we even start servicing the family, talking to them about what's important to them, how I like asking questions about, you know, how will the family or the client know that the intervention was successful? What do they think, what do they see as successful? What are some of their priorities? Like, I was working with someone that told me, you know, I'm working with this family and they're very religious. They actually, what they want me to work on is on the child being able to go to church with them without having, without being too overstimulating. And for the family, that was important because they went to service every week, every weekend. And the child was missing out on that because of some of behavior challenges that the child was having. And they wanted, you know, that was a priority for the family so that the child didn't miss out on that, right? So that's, I think, you know, really important. And related to that, I think knowing what questions to ask. And that's something sometimes I think where we can get hung up on, especially if we're still not very fluent in our cultural diversity, cultural humility. There's a couple of really good books in ABA, some articles that are really good. There's actually a culturally sensitive, or I can't remember the exact word, but there's a question, like a self-assessment published on JABA not too long ago on, you know, determining how comfortable you are on your cultural responsivity, cultural humility. But I know, for example, that that's an issue that a lot of, like you said, practitioners have, because they might not know how to best ask those questions. So that's something that I'm actually working on at the moment. one of my collaborators and I, my friend Kristen, who was actually my BCBA supervisor, and now we do research together. Her and I are working on what we call a culturally responsive intake survey or questionnaire or tool. I don't know what we call it. We keep changing it. But we're developing a set of 10, 11 questions that we're hoping practitioners can ask to get to the root of that, right? What is important to you and your family? What works for you and your family? I think religious diversity is also really important. And sometimes we don't take that into consideration, but asking those questions if the family is comfortable as well, like how does religion impact your day-to-day life? How would you want to see that, you know, or would you like to see that in any way, taken into account when programming your child's communication interventions, behavioral interventions, and so on. So I think going back to your original question, informing ourselves, being aware of where we are, where we stand in regards to cultural sensitivity, cultural humility, doing that work, that pre-assessment on ourselves, and there's tools out there for that. And then filling in the blanks. How can we learn more? How can we be open? What areas, if I'm working with a family that just moved here from Syria, what do I need to know, even if it's just Googling? What religion do people practice in Syria? What are the eating practices? So that we are a little bit better prepared for when we go into the homes or we're working with the family in clinic or in school.
And you've had the chance to work with children with disabilities in other Spanish-speaking countries. I mean, you were in Panama. Like, I mean, you've seen that. And I would imagine that most families would appreciate the asking of the questions. Is that it's not, I mean, oftentimes we pull back because we think, oh, I'm going to offend somebody. But it's almost more offensive not to ask or try and learn or be conscientious to understanding. I don't know it all. And I think what you're hitting at is, you know, trying to inform yourself. It's not a weakness that you don't know. It's empowering to get more information, to be able to make good decisions. So, I mean, we touched on so many of the important things as far as how to be able to incorporate a lot of the communication strategies across cultures, across different modalities. I do want to hit a little bit more on the AAC component because it's not used, I don't think, as frequently as it should be, even as a tool to be able to promote language. Say you really want to get to vocalization. Sometimes is that there's this middle ground that utilizing AAC will help to promote over time, yet give that child the opportunity to communicate in the interim. So how do you make sure that you're utilizing all the tools in your belt? Do you recommend that, you know, we're looking at strength-based assessments from the beginning to understand how somebody's processing, how they're communicating better? I could even see this helping with bilingualism, is that in the home, it's easy with pictures, is that regardless of who you are, you can start communicating with your own child as they're developing the language skills to potentially be bilingual over time. But can you give me a little bit of a picture of, you know, what we need to be doing when we're assessing the language ability or the communication ability of an individual?
You mean in regards to being culturally sensitive or identifying what may work best for the student?
I think I don't know those the two things. I think that they go together, don't they?
Yeah. So I think especially when it comes to communication, we have some knowledge as behavior therapists, right? But I think that part is something that I always recommend we do in consultation with speech and language therapists. And I know that can be a point of, you know, friction between our fields. I've worked with some SLPs that, you know, completely think, you know, I don't like collaborating with BCBAs because they think they know better than me. And that was my experience with two or three speech and language therapists when I started doing some of this work in AAC. They're like, oh, well, you know, a lot of behavior therapists don't consider AAC to be real communication. And they don't see AAC communication as in a way real. So I am a big proponent for interdisciplinary collaboration when it comes to communication, but we do need to work a lot there on, you know, as a field, what we're doing and how we're teaching students to collaborate with other fields, and know that we don't have all the answers, because that's what's really important when we are assessing. And when we're assessing communication, we have knowledge, but I consider them to be the experts, right? They're going to be able to tell us, okay, this student, because of their motor difficulties, you know, they might be able to do some signs, but with them, we might need a scanning device, or we might need a device that that is easier for them to touch something. And they have the knowledge of that. They have the expertise on that. And they, when it comes to AEC, they're going to be the ones that are going to be able to tell us that. And then based on that, we can choose something that will work not only in our setting, in the professional setting, but then it can, that families will see as useful in the home. So
absolutely. No, I mean, and that makes so much sense. But as a practitioner, sometimes you're so rushed to get to decision making and rushed to get the answer that the process you kind of miss out on, which leaves you without the best answer, right? But
and sometimes we work in silos, right? Like we work in the ABA clinic here. Like I come from a teaching background where we do it together as the IEP team. But I know that in the clinician, like a lot of clinicians don't have that unless you're in a center that provides wraparound services, which we don't have that many of those. You are working with a child communication here, and then, you know, the speech and language therapist is across town and we don't even talk. So that's one of the challenges of our field, I think, as well, when it comes to communication and communication interventions.
And you're mentioning the challenges, and you've been doing a lot of research, and you've been presenting on some of these challenges that exist within the field. And even just talking today, you've already put out there, yeah, you know what, I was thinking about this and how I can incorporate this into research. I'd love to know, you know, when you're looking at, and you had mentioned already collaboration, cultural competency and awareness and decision making, but as an advocate for diversity and equity in special education and treatment, what do you see as the most pressing issue right now within the field?
I think age of diagnosis is a really, really big one for the field. And I would say that everything else trickles down from that. Because if we are not identifying, you know, we still are identifying Black children, Latino children, Asian children later than white children. And we know that early intervention, 6 months, a year, can make such a world of difference in the skills, the abilities, the independent abilities of our students and our children, so our clients. So I think that's the main one. Age of diagnosis, and then after that, and kind of related to that also, accessing services, just being able to access. We're not even talking here about bilingual services, but wait lists are so long for so many services, and they're even longer in places that end up being deserts. I have a good friend that works at UT San Antonio, and she was telling me they're the only ones in the big in their area, in the San Antonio area, that can provide some of the ABA services that they provide to the downtown, the area that needs it the most, right? People that may be from low income, middle income backgrounds, and don't have money for a lot of the private services. So access services, age of diagnosis, access services. And then from that, then having services and providers that are culturally sensitive first, and then hopefully we have also providers that may be bilingual that then can help us, you know, do that code switching, but kind of like a hierarchy in my mind. We need the age of diagnosis, the access, and then culturally sensitive, and then hopefully they'll get to be bilingual as well.
Yeah, I mean, that feels like barrier on top of barrier on top of barrier right now, and even just getting better at breaking down one of those gets us at least some footing and some progress and moving forward. So what resources would you recommend to a parent, to a clinician, to a school district right now, based on what we were talking today about communication and making sure that you're really looking at some of those culturally appropriate communication strategies? What resources are out there?
I think for clinicians learning more about collaboration, there's plenty of articles, books about how to be better at collaborating with other fields. I think learning about that, informing ourselves, being open to knowing that we don't have all the answers, being humble, culturally humble, but also professionally humble in that way. For parents, I really love the book, the books ABA Visualize, and now they have them in English and Spanish, which is neat because then it's more accessible for everybody. And for AAC, I really like, if you Google AAC Learning Moodle, Moodle, out of Penn State, they have a series of free learning modules, Moodles they call them, on AAC. The first one is just intro to AAC, but then they have some on funding, they have some geared more towards caregivers, and then they have others geared more towards professionals, which can really help bridge that gap in knowledge as well.
Well, Naima, I appreciate you taking the time today, but even more so challenging a lot of the thoughts that are out there in the field and pushing us to become better clinicians by bringing to light some of the things that maybe we haven't answered yet. So thank you. I appreciate your time today. And maybe we can have you back on again some other time and we can go deeper into some of these subjects.
Thank you so much. That was fun. I would love that.
Thank you for listening to Autism Weekly. We hope you tune back in next week to learn more about autism in the real world. Autism Weekly is now found on all the major listening apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Subscribe to be notified when we post a new podcast. Autism Weekly is produced by ABS Kids. ABS Kids is proud to provide diagnostic assessments and ABA therapy to children with developmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. You can learn more about ABS Kids and the Autism Weekly podcast by visiting abskids.com. Thanks for tuning in. See you again next week.